Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, a conversation with Trevor Noah. This program is being rebroadcast. It was originally recorded nearly 4 years ago, on November 21st, 2016, just following the election of Donald Trump. Since 2015, Noah has hosted The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He'll speak with Laureen Powell-Jobs, the founder and president of Emerson Collective, an organization supporting social entrepreneurs, about growing up in South Africa, the son of a Black South African mother and a white European father, at a time when it was against the law for Blacks and whites to have children together. He'll also talk about the ways that comedy can help process painful events and speak truth to corruption. His politically minded monologues have done both throughout the past 4 years. Join us now as we rebroadcast a conversation with Trevor Noah.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Hello. Oh.
They love you in San Francisco.
Thank you very much for coming out, everyone.
The world is looking a lot different than it did 2 weeks ago, Trevor. And comedy might be more important than ever before in an era of President Trump. How do you balance the responsibility to give issues like racism the gravity they deserve with your obligation to make us laugh?
Well, I think the great truth about comedy is that you don't need to choose between great comedy and being honest or exposing absurdities, because that's what great comedy is supposed to do. You know, if you look throughout time at many great comedic voices, the one thing that holds true and consistent is the fact that they spoke truth to what was going on. And over time, I have learned and continue to learn those lessons, you know, in how I use comedy to process the information that is before me. I don't think that anything is funny, but if it wasn't for comedy, I wouldn't be able to process what's happening. I don't think any of us would, you know, on the face of it. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, for instance, is, slowly creating what seems to be, a neo-Nazi regime before our very eyes. There is nothing particularly funny about that.
No.
But if we don't focus on his orange hue, then there is nothing that'll give us a slight reprieve from the pain. So I think that's really what comedy is. It's two things. One, it's an anesthetic of the mind, I find, for myself. Mm. It doesn't mean that what's happening isn't there. It just helps you cope with the pain of what's going on. And the second thing it does, which is almost as important, is it exposes and mocks the target of the comedy. Because we also shouldn't be in a place where we give or grant people like Donald Trump the reverence that they so desperately require from us. Mm. That's not what we're here to do. And, you know, one of my favorite stories was from Charlie Chaplin, who, when he made The Dictator, said he regretted it. He said, he didn't know that Hitler would go on to be so dangerous and he wouldn't have made a joke about it. But then I read a fascinating story of soldiers who were fighting in the war. And they said up until that point, they believed Hitler undefeatable. They had been fighting, they had been losing. They did not think that this mastermind, this tactician, could be defeated. And then the soldiers talk about how when they watched that movie for the first time, they did something they had never done before, and that was they laughed at Hitler.
Uh-huh.
It exposed a side of him that people had never seen. It exposed something, and it's so much easier to go up against an idea or a person when you believe them to be fallible. And that's the importance of comedy for me. Okay. So
wow.
you have to keep laughing.
Yeah. But part of what we saw in the election is that as Americans, we're not necessarily listening to each other. And so do you see that as any part of your role to make sure that we're listening closely to each other and understanding some of the pain that caused this choice among the electorate?
I think the tough thing to do is pin down the cause of Donald Trump's election. You know, I've seen everyone who has an answer. And I feel like everyone is falling into the trap that they fell into before, and that was the trap of knowing as opposed to asking. Uh-huh. Everyone knew that Hillary was going to win. Everyone knew why Trump would lose. Everyone knew why the Republicans would denounce him. Everyone knew. And I found it surprising how, I mean, like, everyone knew with the polls. And I honestly came in as a first-timer to an American election from the inside, and I remember asking everyone around me, I said, why do you trust these polls so much? Then they said, because that's what we use. And I said, but explain a poll to me. I said, well, we go out and we ask people who they're going to vote for. I said, and that's it? I said, and that's,
well,
that determines
it?
And they were like, yeah. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, ask me who I'm going to vote for. And they were like, who are you going to vote for? I said, I'll vote for Trump. And then they were like, oh, yeah. I was like, no, I can't vote. But that's not the point. The point is I can tell you whatever I want. I didn't understand it. And I think that's sometimes the thing is being in a position where you ask the right questions. You know, that's the one thing I always admire about children, is children will always expose how ludicrous your world is, because you'll be living your life the way you've always lived it, and then it takes a child to come in and just go, why? Why? Why?
Yes.
And then you're like, I don't know. I've never asked why. and that's what it boils down to now, is it's yes, one of the aspects is a country that hasn't been listening. Yes, there are aspects of globalization that have affected this, because this is also a global movement. You know, populism and right-wing populism is growing around the world.
Yeah.
I think, if anything, the biggest answer America got from this election is that America is not as immune to the ills of the world as it once was. You know, the gifts and curse of globalization are that, yes, you can get a message and a product from the other side of the world in an instant, but it also means that a message that may be negative, you can receive at the same speed.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something that I feel America needs to learn, is that the answers are out there. What's happening is happening everywhere on different timelines. And so now's a time to look to the world for the answers, to see what's working or not working.
Well, something that's not working is the ability of people to distinguish between what's true, what's real news, and what's fake news.
Yes.
And Comedy Central pioneered the use of fake news in The Daily Show, and you're continuing it. And of course, it was originally designed to illuminate absurdities, and unfortunately, it's been used to anesthetize individuals to what's real and what's not real. So how do you see the role of fake news and real news, and how can people become savvier consumers of information?
Well, that's where a greater conversation has to be had within the tech community. You know, one of the biggest concerns we have in the world right now is the advancement of technology. We want progress. But you never want progress to advance beyond the point of us being able to be in control of it. You hear conversations about artificial intelligence, and it's always a fun discussion to have. Do we trust the robots? Do we not? Are they going to kill us? They're going to kill us. They're all going to kill us. The robots are going to kill us. But those are discussions that need to be had, because essentially you want to know what's going to happen. And the same thing goes for the Facebooks and the Twitters and so on. They can no longer hide in a space where they go, oh no, we don't, we just let the people do whatever they want to do, we don't control the news. It's like, yes, but you are facilitating this. And so if people are using your platform as a tool, mm-hmm. to misinform people, then you have to hold them accountable. It's a scary place to be in, though, where, I mean, even General Flynn, who Trump is appointing to be part of his cabinet, he himself has fallen to false news. I mean, this is a person who's going to be in charge of parts of the military, and this person may read a story about Kazakhstan attacking you because of what Borat said, and then now there could be a war. I mean, that is, it's ludicrous, and it's really frightening, but I never thought I would say this, but people are going to wish that, you know, they're going to go, oh man, I miss the days of Fox News when we knew where the news,
yes.
came from that was throwing people off, because now there is no source. And that's really scary.
So how can people equip themselves to be better determiners of what's real and what's not real? And while algorithms can be designed and be out front to signal things to people, people actually need to take responsibility for being savvy consumers.
Yeah, the most important thing to do is just to read. It's just to investigate. I always tell people that. I go, just ask one more person. If you see it online, just Google it. One additional search.
Yeah.
When you get that news, just one more. Think of it like this. Let's say you received the news of a death of a family member that you really hated on Facebook. You would call one other family member to ask if it's true before you celebrate. You would call somebody and you'd be like, "Uncle, is it true? Is she gone?" And he'd go, no, that was a mistake.
Was
just trying to
news.
Say birthday, and then it was death day, and then it was a whole thing. And be like, oh, well, I thought I should call you first. But you wouldn't now start writing. And I feel like people need to apply the same level. It's just being, being smart about it. It's common sense. Just asking, just questioning yourself, going, it's not a headline. What is in the story? Because we've been caught in a world of clickbait, and we have to be the change, essentially, because everybody is being caught out by it. Everybody. It's like counterfeit money. I don't know if you remember, there was a time when we all used to hold the money up. Once that became, once the money was prolific, everyone knew there was a good chance you were going to get a counterfeit bill. And so everyone walked around. Uh-huh. Every time someone gave you a bill, you'd do that. And that's what we need to do with our news now. Uh-huh. Every time we get a story, we need to hold it up into the light and see if it holds true. And then we move on.
So do you predict having a very robust set of incidents to report on over the next 4 years at The Daily Show?
You know what? I don't predict anything, but this is one thing I can predict, unfortunately. We are in for one hell of a ride. And this is one of those rides where, when you get to the theme park, the coaster goes around a corner, so you don't even know what's happening there. Is it going to drop? Is it going to rise? Is it going to spin? Is it going to flip? Is it going to be racist? We don't know what this coaster is going to do. What we do know is we're going to need to buckle up. We're going to need to keep each other protected. We're going to have to be vigilant. And the most important thing is to realize the power and the importance of shame in a world like this. And that's, I guess, from my experience growing up in apartheid South Africa, protests helped, boycotts helped, embargoes helped, but one of the biggest tectonic shifts that we experienced in the country was when the international community shamed our country, when they shamed the apartheid government. There comes a point where your nation can no longer look other nations in the eye. And once that happens, you will feel a shift internally. So we just have to be vigilant amongst one another. We shouldn't let anything go by. There is no moment where we now slip into using their language, as alt-right. There's nothing right about the altness. It's neo-Nazism. That's what it is.
Yeah, let's call
and
it that.
If you wait until it's too late to say it,
let's call it that.
You can fall prey to it.
So let's talk about your book.
Let's.
Yes. So you're a comedian, so I think people expect your book to be funny. But it's you actually deal with a lot of suffering and tragic issues. However, it's really excellent book. I have to tell people, do not start the book later than 7 p.m. at night, because it will ruin your night's sleep. It's that good. It's one of those that you don't want to put down.
Thank you.
So why don't you start by telling us about how you came to the title, Born a Crime?
Well, the title presented itself, fortunately and unfortunately. I was born in South Africa during a time known as apartheid. And apartheid was a system of laws that made it illegal. One of the laws was the Immorality Act, and this law made it illegal for black and white people to interact with one another, specifically in terms of relationships. Interrelations were forbidden, and this was awkward for me because I grew up in a mixed family. Well, with me being the mixed one in the family, my my mother's a black woman, Xhosa woman from South Africa. My father is Swiss from Switzerland, so he was a white man, and so, he still is. And so they got together during apartheid, which was against the law, and they broke these laws not just by being together, but by having me. Yeah. And so, in essence, I was born a crime.
And at the time, it was illegal for your mother to have had what's called a colored child.
Yes.
But it was not illegal for two colored people to have a colored child.
Yes.
So you write in the book that there was a woman that your mother hired to pose as your mother so that you could all three go to the park, or she could go to the park with you.
Yeah, my mom was really brilliant, and I genuinely do not know where she got it from. But she was brilliant at mm-hmm. navigating through and around systems that were oppressive but also ridiculous. You know, imagine growing up in a world where I was considered a completely different race to either of my parents. I was also afforded different liberties because of that. So my father, being white, was afforded all freedoms and every privilege that came with being white in South Africa during that time. My mother, as a black person, was the oppressed class. But I was in between the two of them. And that's what apartheid was all about, separating people into as many subgroups as possible because they were trying to control a majority. And at the time, the apartheid government, I mean, they were the minority. So my mom found so many ways to navigate through the system. She realized that, yes, she was a black woman. She had this child who was termed colored. That's the term for the skin tone in South Africa. And so what she did was, instead of letting this stop her, she used the ridiculousness of the system in her favor. So if she walked with me in the streets, she would just dress like a maid. And so no one would ask questions because clearly the maid was looking after the child that, you know, was the child of someone who was superior to her. And then if there was a police crackdown, she would just get a woman who was my skin tone to walk with us, and she would act like she was my mom's employer, and her name was Queen. And so we'd walk around together in the streets, and I have a picture where it's myself, my mom, and Queen, and Queen and I are together, and she looks exactly like me, Queen. And then my mom is in the back, and it looks like she's photobombing the picture. And whenever I'd show people that picture, like, everyone would say, they'd go like, oh, your mom looks like that. I'd say, no, she's the one in the back. She's the one in the background. People are like, oh, okay. Oh, I can see the resemblance. I can see the resemblance. But that was the world that we had to navigate. Mm. You know, one of the stories, I didn't even remember it this way because I was really lucky in that my parents, I think, shielded me from a lot of the ills or the realities of the world we were in, was my mom tried once to take us out as a family, you know, for a walk. And so my dad...
You and...
Me and my father and my mom, which couldn't happen. That was just, I mean, a black man, white woman already was a problem. A family would expose what they had done. So we went out to a place called Joubert Park, which is basically the central park of Johannesburg. And we're in the park together. And my dad always walked, you know, a good distance away from us when we were walking around because he couldn't be seen with us. Mm. And so I thought that was the most normal thing as a child. I just, you know, dads are there, that's it. I never judged any, like it was, because people always ask me that question. They go, oh, it must have been sad. I'm like, no. I just thought dads walk on the other side of the road. You know, like I would see other people as dads and be like, your dad's so clingy. Why is he, you know, it just made sense to me because that's all I knew. And he still loved me and I got to see him indoors. So we went out to the park and then I was like, we're at the park. So I started chasing him. And I started screaming, daddy, daddy, daddy. And people would, you know, would turn and they're looking. They're going, where's the daddy of this thing? And there's only a white man. And then he ran away from me. And so
you chased him further.
I chased him because I was like, oh, the game is on. I love this. So I'm chasing him. And then my mom had to start chasing me. And so in my world, I'm like, it's a great day at the park, running with my family. What a beautiful day. And they were terrified because their child, you know, could have easily got them into a lot of trouble.
And they could have been arrested.
My mom was arrested. My mom was arrested many times.
For being your mother?
Not for being my mother. Luckily, that's one thing she was never caught doing, was being my mom. It's a strange thing to say. But really, that was one of the things we were lucky about, is that she was never caught in that in that position. She was caught fraternizing with my father, and she was caught being in a white area after curfew or without possessing the correct permit. And so whenever that happened, she was, you know, she was sent to jail. She would spend a day in jail, a week in jail, a few weeks, and she would have to pay a fine. And that fine was oftentimes a month or two salary. You couldn't call your family to let them know that you were in jail, which was a frightening situation to be in, because most families were losing people to this police state all the time. So when your loved ones disappeared, you didn't know if they were gone forever or if they were just detained. My mom continued to do that. She would pay the fine and she would go back and she'd get caught again. And she resisted. That was her protest, and that was how she lived.
You really write so beautifully about her, and all of her strengths and savviness are so well represented in your story. And in fact, really, her story is at the center of the narrative arc of your book.
Oh, yeah.
So why did you decide to put her at the center of the memoir? Because of all of her beautiful strengths and attributes in this way?
Well, no, I didn't plan that at all. I thought that I was the hero of my story.
I'm sorry.
Many of us do.
I guess that's
no,
just how
no,
I
no.
Read it.
This is honestly what happened. I set out to write my book. I set out to write my stories. And, you know, I had told my friends some stories, and I'd met people all over the world, friends that I had made, and everyone would tell me, that's a great story, that's a wild story, you should tell that. I can't believe this life you've lived. And so I set out to write the stories. And once I was done, I sat with my editor, and we coalesced everything, and we put the pieces together. And then he looked at me, and he said, you realize this is a book about your mom. And I was like, no, there must be something wrong. And I went through it, and every single story I had to tell, and I mean, it makes sense, I was a child, but it really is a beautiful story, because when you think about it, that's essentially what I feel every child should feel, is that they are the ones who are flying through their own lives. They are the ones who are autonomous and making decisions, and yet when you zoom out for a second, you realize, you know, I realized that my mom was the person who was constantly guiding me and taking me through every single journey we experienced. And so I'm glad I didn't intend it, because then I think it would have been a little bit contrived. But essentially, the book went from being a story about me to it turned into a love letter to my mom.
Yeah.
And I always respected my mom. I've always loved my mom. We've always been really close, which has been great. But after writing the book, I realized how much more I appreciated her. I realized how many lessons she taught me. I realized how much we had been through together. And I laughed, and I said this to a friend the other day. I said, I'm glad I wrote the book now and not when I was younger, because I don't think I would have been a normal child had I respected my mom as much as I do now. So, so I think it happened at the right time.
I wonder if you could tell a few stories from the book. A few that struck me were some of her parenting techniques, not the beating part, but the letter writing bit.
Yes.
Was absolutely fantastic. And then there's another story when you were all kidnapped, and it turned out to be something humorous, and it seems like it's not on the face of it anything that would be funny, but
yes.
In the end, it seems like you guys were bent over laughing.
That was the theme of our lives. You know, we went through some really tough times, as many of us have. And, you know, when I tell these stories, the one thing I hope everyone takes away from the book is that this is not a sad story at all. This is a story of triumph. It's a story that is truthful. It's a story that is meant to connect with people through specificity. You know, I find with every story, the more specific you get, the more broad the themes become. And I experienced that in every story. You know, like you say, being kidnapped with my mom or her teachings. My mom was a voracious reader, still is, continues to search for answers and meaning in life. You know, she's not one of those people who believe she knows, which I always admired about her, especially as an adult, because I grew up in a community where adults knew, and that was it. And your goal as a child was to become an adult so that you too knew. That's all you wanted. But my mom always said to me, she'd always say, challenge me. She'd always say to me, she'd say, challenge me. If you don't agree with me, tell me why you don't agree with me. Tell me what, show me why I'm wrong. Don't be disobedient, but tell me why. Help me see your point of view. Challenge me. She always said that to me. She said, you must challenge me. You must challenge me. And, you know, and challenge her, I did. You know, and we used to fight a lot. And one of the things we used to fight about was doing chores. So I hated chores, right?
This sounds normal.
Yeah, I was a normal child. But I had to help my mom around the house. She would work long hours, so I had to wash the dishes. I would sweep the house. You know, I'd help do the washing. And that we didn't have a washing machine, so this was manual washing the clothes in the bath and destroy my knuckles, and I have nice hands. And so I would always try and get away with doing as little as possible because I just wanted to play. And, you know, my mom would say, Trevor, I need your help. I need you to pick up the slack. I need your help. And I would always catch her out on technicalities because my mom's memory is not great at all. And I have a fantastic memory. I always used to say I have the memory of an elephant. And so my mom and I would argue, and I would beat her in the argument because I would find little technicalities where she'd miss a story or a beat. And so what she started doing was she started corresponding with me via letters.
She was a secretary.
Yes, so my mom had gone to a typing course, a little typing school, and she had learned to be a secretary, and which was ridiculous when she learned, by the way, because at that time, black people weren't allowed to have office jobs. They were working in factories, and what she did was, it was madness, you know? But it actually paid off, because then the country, thanks to shame, the country had a program that they instituted, which was really a facade, where they said, no, look, we're hiring black people into positions. And so they started actively hiring black people. And my mom got one of those jobs that the government instituted. And so what happened was my mom was a really, really good typist. And so she decided that she couldn't rely on word of mouth anymore, so she would write letters to me. So if I hadn't done my chores, she would write me a letter. And, you know, she'd go, Dear Trevor. And she'd always start with a Bible scripture, you know, it would be like Matthew something, verse something, and then she'd be like, children, be good to your parents and listen to them, you know, for then you will be good and the earth will reap its rewards and blah, blah, blah. And then she'd say to me, Trevor, I asked you to wash the dishes and I asked you to clean your room, but you still haven't cleaned your room. And, you know, Trevor, this is why I keep teaching you that if you don't listen to me, then you won't listen to your world. And if you don't listen to the world, the law is the thing that you will break next. Learn to follow the law of the house, and then you will follow the law of the land. And, you know, being and she'd just write this long letter, and she'd slip that under my door. And so I'd get this letter. And, I mean, at this time, I'm like, what, 11 years old, 12? And so I'd get the letter. And I used to help my mom with late-night correspondence. Sometimes she'd have to type up a lot of letters late at night. And I love typing as well. So I knew how to type a basic letter. So I would get this letter from my mom. And so I would go into, like, her room where she had a little typewriter. And I'd feed in my page. And then I would type my reply. And I'd be like, to whom it may concern. Like, to whom it may concern, dear mom, I have received your correspondence, and I tried to be as verbose as possible to make it seem like I knew what I was talking about. Words were scrambled all over the page. I'd be like, mom, I have processed everything that you have sent me. All correspondence hitherto has been received in accordance. I would, however, like to challenge you on a few of the points. The dishes were done. Unfortunately, additional dishes were added after my initial washing of the dishes had been completed. Kind regards, Trevor Noah, your son. And then I would give that to her, and then she would type one back. And we would do this for like a week. And the great thing was, because of that, we didn't fight in person. So in person, we were like, how was your day? Oh, everything's great. What are you doing at school? Whatever, whatever. And then it would be like, and here's your letter. And then, you know, And that's how we found a way to communicate. In terms of kidnapping, I mean, it's a long story to try and tell, but, it's funny. In America, they call it kidnapping. Let's start there. I don't even say I was kidnapped. I don't even think I write the word kidnapped in the book. But according to the law, what happened to us was kidnapping. We were taken by people, and what happened was we were using public transportation to get us home from church. And on the day in question, my mom and I were waiting for what we call them taxis in South Africa. They're different to taxis in America. They're more like minibuses that you often see in third world countries, you know, like a little minibus that holds 16 people. And on the night in question, we got picked up by one. But before that, my mom, failing to get us a taxi, tried to hitchhike. And a man stopped and agreed to give us a ride. And in South Africa at the time, the taxi industry was very, very violent, extremely violent. And one of the things they were fundamentally opposed to was people stealing their customers. Mm-hmm. And so as we got this Good Samaritan who stopped and agreed to give us a ride, a taxi drove by, saw this, and cut us off and accused that man of trying to steal his business. And, you know, a whole racket ensued. And my mom told the taxi driver, no, he wasn't doing anything, let him go. And the guy drove off, and my mom said, we're your customers, and we got in the taxi. And then during the ride, this was late at night, though. This is, you know, now going on maybe 9 p.m., and I'm in the taxi, and I'm falling asleep. My eyes are, you know, I'm trying to stay awake, but I can't. It's myself, my mom, and my baby brother. At this time, he was less than a year old. And I can hear my mom arguing with the driver, and the driver is, you know, berating my mom, telling her how, you know, she's a whore for getting into a strange man's car, and, you know, this is why, you know, women like her need to be taught a lesson. And he starts going off and he's ranting. And these were things I was familiar with. Unfortunately, my mom clearly realized that we were in grave danger. And so she asked the man to let us out, and he refused. And so my mom turned to me and she said, Trevor, at the next traffic light, when he slows down, because he was slowing down at every intersection just to make sure there were no cars. She said, at the next intersection, when he slows down, we jump out. And I was half asleep when I heard this. I'm, at the time, 9 years old. I hear people fighting. I don't even think this is, she says, the next traffic light, we jump out. And in my head, I'm going, jump out as in get out. That's a term you use, you know. And I fell asleep. And the next thing I knew was a blast of cold air, and then I was rolling on the ground, just tumbling, dirt in my mouth, my clothes everywhere. And I got up, and I looked up, and my mom was rolling next to me, and she looked at me, and she said, run! And we ran. And I didn't even ask her why. I just ran, you know. And that was, I guess, you know, part of growing up in a country that at the time was experiencing a lot of crime. You didn't ask questions. I didn't stand and say, why are we running? You run. And the men chased us for a little bit, but they had no chance of catching us. And, you know, and we ran, and we finally got to safety. And we ran to a gas station where there were lights and people were attending. And my mom and I were there, and we were both bleeding. You know, our knees were bleeding. I still have the scars today. And I said to her, I turned and I said, what the hell? I said, what the hell happened there? And she says, I told you to jump. Why didn't you jump? And I said, jump where? I was sleeping. And she says, those men were going to kill us. I told you to jump, and you didn't jump, so I pushed you out. So then I was like, what? And she says, yes. She says, those men were going to kill us. I'm like, you almost killed me. And so she goes, no, I was trying to protect you. And then she goes, and I said, but I was sleeping. I said, at least those men didn't wake me up. Like, you know, and we're like arguing back and forth, and she goes, and she looks at me, and we had just, the reason we were in the situation is because we went to a late night church service. And I'll never forget, my mom says to me, you know, we're bleeding and we're patting ourselves down. And she says, oh, thank God we're safe. Thank God. And I said, what? I said, God is the reason we're here. What are you talking about? I said, he's the only reason we came out. If it wasn't for God, we wouldn't be here. And she was like, yep, thank God. Thank God we're safe. And, you know, and that was really our journey together. As we laughed afterwards. We know we laughed through that pain. We experienced grave danger together, but most importantly, we were a team, and we always communicated through laughter. Mm.
And so that happened at the end of a long day of going to a series of churches, which was not unlike your typical Sunday.
No,
you had at least
very
three
common
church services that you guys would attend. So talk to us a little bit about the role of religion in your life.
Well, I mean, religion and my life, and to a larger extent, the life of a South African person, especially a South African person of color, you couldn't You couldn't separate the two. South Africa was obviously colonized, but the missionaries played a big role in the country in educating people who the government felt shouldn't be educated. So during South Africa's worst times, one of the things that was stripped away from the natives was education. If you were a person who was black, it wasn't deemed necessary for you to receive certain skills, mm-hmm. so you wouldn't learn math or science. You know, the phrase they often used was, they said, the Bantu has no use for math and science. The Bantu is meant to toil in the fields. Mm. And so they would teach black people agricultural skills. You know, they would teach them dressmaking. They would teach them menial skills. And so my mom was lucky in that where she grew up in the countryside, there was a missionary who taught English and who taught math. And these missionaries played a large role in the long term in South Africa, fighting for its freedom. So religion was a real big part of the country. You know, religion was obviously forced on the natives, but it was adopted over time. And I grew up in an extremely religious family. You know, religion was how my household was run. My grandmother was religious, my aunt was religious, my mom, everybody I knew was religious. And so because of that, church was a huge part of my life. My mom was and still is extremely religious. You know, we would go to church on a Sunday, 3 to 4 times just on a Sunday. You know, so we would start at one service, and every service had a different purpose for my mom. We would go to one church, which was basically, it was a church called Rosebank Union, which was, for all intents and purposes, a church that only white people attended. And it was white people and myself and my mom. And my mom loved that church because of, you know, how analytical they were of the Bible. She loved how, she said, the pastor there was really meticulous in interpreting what the scripture meant and what mm-hmm. the meanings were behind everything. And he was very stiff, you know, the church, all things bright and beautiful. It was like one of those churches. And then after that, we would go to a more multicultural church where, you know, there's like a Christian rock band, and they would have like the lyrics on screens, you know, like the karaoke style thing. And then after that, our final destination would be black church. You know, we'd go to the township, and that was inspired by evangelical churches in the United States. So mm-hmm. it was out in, you know, in a field with a giant tent, and people are burning, and everyone fanning themselves, and demons are getting kicked out of people, and you know,
was that your favorite one?
I loved that. Oh, yeah. As a kid, I was like, this is where the action is.
Yeah.
This is, I was like, every time I'd be at the white church, I'd be looking at people going, where are your demons? Where are your, because you knew when you went to like an evangelical church, it's not like, unlike America, that was the only place where it happened, was in the black church. You know, you'd get there, and then someone would stand up, and they'd start screaming, and you'd be like, oh, it's on. And then that person would get tackled by everyone, and the pastor would come and start rebuking the demons. And it was really exciting. It just took too long, though. Black church took forever. It was like, I remember white church, we were in and out within an hour, done.
Very
service
efficient.
Was completed. Yeah. Black church it was the longest. Like, if you've ever been to a black church, like, you're probably still there now. Like, you you know how long it is. And I always used to think as a kid, I used to think, the reason black people spent so long in church was because they needed Jesus more. Like, I always felt like black people were like, oh, no, we're not done yet, and this and that and this and that. But what was really great was, more than anything, religion gave us community. You know, my mom and I spent so much time being outsiders that the church was the one place where we had a tribe that existed beyond race. You know, because as much as it was a white church, it was the one place where it was all white, and yet I never felt like I didn't belong, because as long as you were a child of God, you were accepted in the church. And that's really what the role church played in our lives. No matter where we were and what we were doing, it was the sense of community that lived with us. I always challenged my mom in religion, though, because I, you know, there were many facets of religion that I just logically could not accept. And my mom accepted that challenge, but that was like our place where we were together. And as a kid, mm-hmm. I loved religion. I loved, like, because I wasn't allowed to indulge in much pop culture, you know, religion was my pop culture. So yeah. I didn't enjoy Superman. Samson was my superhero. Mm-hmm. You know, I was was the world that I lived in. Mm-hmm. I was reading up on Joseph
well,
and Moses.
There's a lot of drama in the Bible.
There is. Yeah. And there's a lot of fantasy, and it's exciting. And so, so religion really was a core part of my mom and I's relationship, mm-hmm. and how we process the world around us.
And something else that I found fascinating about your childhood is that you spoke many, many languages. And even though you talk about being an outsider in your family, outside of your family, you actually, I don't know if you compensated for your outsiderness by learning everyone's language, because that allowed you to belong to each group that you were with. So is that how you felt about it?
I don't think I knew this intuitively as a child. First and foremost, I learned it from my mom. So, you know, when I tell people I speak 6 languages, people are impressed, but my mom speaks 9. So she just picked up languages where she went. And I think I realized through my mom how powerful language and the way you speak, your accent, how powerful that tool is. Because my mom would do this thing where, when she would speak to you over the phone, if she spoke English, in South Africa, people who heard my mom over the phone assumed that she was a white woman. And so there were many things that we would get, many places we would go to, where they would afford us the ability to come there because they were under the impression that a white person was coming. You know, so my mom would, you know, there would be an advertisement in the newspaper for, you know, someone would be selling something on like a Craigslist. And we would phone and inquire about it. And you find if you phone that person as a black person, they'd tell you, nope, it's not for sale, it's not here anymore. And my mom would phone, and her name is Patricia, you know, and so she'd phone, and hi, this is Patricia here, we'd like to come. And the people would be like, oh, yes, of course, Patricia. And we'd arrive, and my mom would, like, ring the intercom. It was the funniest thing. Every time it would happen, she'd, like, ring the intercom at somebody's house, and she'd be like, it's Patricia. And they'd be like, oh, we're coming out. And they'd open the gate, and they'd come outside, and my mom would be there with me. And they'd be like, hello, hello. And they'd be like, they'd be like, are you here with Patricia? And mom would say, oh, I am Patricia. And you would see that moment where people would be like, oh, the Patricia? And my mom was brilliant. She knew how to use that. She knew how to use that tool, and she knew how to use language as well. Mm-hmm. You know, language was the reason my mom seamlessly moved between cultures and people. Even in English alone, I find that there are different languages within English.
Oh, yes.
You know? So when you are on the coasts, when you're in the South, when you're in the Midwest, mm-hmm. when you're in... Just small inflections and changes in your language completely change how people react towards you and how they treat you. And I learned how to use that as a child in a world where I was told I didn't belong.
I think it's time for us to open up the floor to questions. I know this is an exciting opportunity for everybody.
Oh, wow, there's a lot of you. I thought there were like 10 people. Okay.
Well, I think people are tucking in.
Hi, Trevor.
Hi there.
Your first comedy special was all about America and coming to America and your impressions of America. You've been here a little bit longer.
Yes.
So with the having been here a little bit longer, having been through pretty crazy election, what are your impressions now? I think it's really interesting to hear the impression from an outsider and having been through apartheid. What can you tell us now from through the looking glass?
Well, I think the painful truth, in my opinion, when looking at America right now is it is not that different to what it was before the election. The difference is the voices that have been emboldened by Donald Trump have become louder, but he did not create them. They have always existed. The rhetoric that he has inspired was already there. And so what happened in this election, one of the effects of this election has been, unfortunately, that America is in a place where now it can no longer hide from its ugly side. And this is something we all try and do, not just as nations, but as people. Mm. It's so much easier to try and gloss over our, you know, the ugliness that's within us, or blemishes within our personalities that we choose not to address. But the truth is, this has always been a part of America. The truth is, this was never addressed. You know, America has always been a place where the good guys beat the bad guys, but there is no conversation had with the bad guys. I always said that to my friend, and this was before the election. I remember I said to a friend of mine who's from Alabama, I said, one thing that always worried me about America is the North never convinced the South that slavery was wrong. They just beat them, and then they told them that things were going to change. But people down south were never convinced that slavery wasn't the right thing to do. And oftentimes, that's what I find American politics is. It's just that the winner takes all, as opposed to the winner being the one who engages people in a discussion and says, hey, this is why we think we are right, and so on. It's just like, all right, you won. Well, we wait until we win, and then we'll impose our will upon you. Mm-hmm. But where America is now is frightening because... You know, my mom always used to say to me, she said, life will continue to teach you lessons. And unfortunately, the ultimate lesson is death. And my mom was really harsh. she cut straight to the chase. And I never used to understand that as a child. I was like, what does that mean? But I understand it more now than ever before. America has been learning these lessons along the way. America has been seeing these people bubble up. America has been seeing these incidents spike every now and again, but nobody addresses them. You know, people move on. America, I find, is a very symptomatic nation as opposed to a nation that seeks out the cause and tries to treat it.
Well, and yes, just look at the prison population.
Exactly. And so now we're in a place where, you know, it's going to be a lesson that America is going to learn. The one upside of this is, I think to myself, maybe Donald Trump is the alien that brings us all together. Whenever I watch movies, I'm always fascinated by how it takes an alien for everyone to be like, okay. I think we've been fighting about the wrong things. Let's focus. And I mean, that's really what it feels like Donald Trump has become. You know, he said he's a man who's going to unify America, and look at it. Now you have Jewish people and black people and women and Muslims. I mean, I saw a rabbi coming out and saying, we're going to register as Muslims if Donald Trump puts this thing forward. And that's the truth of it, is Donald Trump has exposed an ugliness of America, but I think he's also going to expose a very beautiful side of America. And you know, the yin and yang, sometimes you do need to expose the ugliness in order to see the beauty. And if you look at how people are coming together, if you look at how people are rising up, if you look at how people, young people, are getting involved in politics, mm-hmm. it has now become a conversation that is about the us as opposed to the them. I think that is something that is going to be exposed. I just hope that we can come out of it not unscathed, but really with as minimal damage as possible. But It's going to be a tough time, but as, you know, as long as we're in it together, that's all we can hope for.
Hi, Trevor. So excited to be talking with you.
Thank you.
So I saw a piece the other night on The Daily Show that I thought was brilliant, the piece where you were talking about the comparison between Zuma and Trump.
Yes.
And, yeah, that was amazing. And I'm wondering, in America, I feel like we are so narrow-minded, and what I love about what you've been doing with The Daily Show is that I see it opening up and taking an international perspective. But I wonder if, coming from African humor and from international humor, if you're able to bring all of that to the platform of The Daily Show, or are you having to narrow your craft to meet us, and what that's going to look like in the future? Are you aspiring to widen our humor, or are you working with what we're giving you?
Well, I think it happens over time. You know, what I've learned about comedy is, I always say to people, comedy is exactly like sex, in that when you meet a new audience for the first time, you still have to build a familiarity with them. You know, and over time you will grow to become more adventurous and more comfortable with one another, and then you will find yourself doing things you never thought you could. But initially, I have to acknowledge that I'm learning an American audience, and I'm glad that my audience has acknowledged that they're learning me. And you know that the audience over time at The Daily Show has changed. It's become younger. While still some old viewers have stayed on, it's also become more diverse. And it's really just about growing together. It's just about people becoming familiar. I mean, some people just have to get used to the fact that I have an accent, which I understand. The biggest reason I'm looking forward to the future of looking outwards is because I do believe a lot of the time America can find its answers in the world. You know, for too long, I feel like America has existed mm-hmm. in a bubble where America has been, you know, isolationist, not in its foreign policy, but rather in its introspection, you know, in thinking of how to tackle issues and looking at problems. And when you come from a small country, you can't think like that. You have to look at the world. And a good example of that is Brexit. This entire year, and even on The Daily Show, I've tried so many times to make people look at Brexit. I go, just look at this Brexit thing. Look at this Brexit mm-hmm. thing. Just look at the nuance of Brexit. Look at how the campaign was run from the side of Nigel Farage and the UKIPs, and look at how they tricked people. That was the saddest thing for me about Brexit. Wasn't that it was voted on, and it wasn't the fact that it was an older vote that got it passed, and it wasn't the fact that it was a whiter vote that got it passed. That didn't stress me as much as the fact that they tricked the people who voted for it. Because they said, we're going to bring £350 million into healthcare, and that's what Brexit is all about. And immediately after the vote, they started recanting and said, hey, no, that number may have been a little bit inflated, yes. And actually we shouldn't have said that, and actually we're still going to be cutting back on healthcare services. And I was so shocked at how easily they had manipulated uh-huh. constituents. And I said this at the show, I said this on TV, I said, just watch out for that thing. It can happen in America. Because when people, you cannot deny that many Americans are frustrated. You cannot deny that people are afraid. You cannot deny that people feel like they're not in the place where they once were. You can't deny that the middle class isn't growing at the rate that it once was. You can't deny that, you know, it's a jobless recovery. These are all things that play into people's decisions. And unfortunately, when people become desperate or when they feel threatened, which is sometimes more important than actually being threatened, they then act against their best interests because they're convinced that it's not. And so when you look internationally, I feel like you can get your answers. So like now, with my president, Jacob Zuma, and America's president-elect, Donald Trump, that's the only thing I'm saying to people. I realized I can't be afraid to say it anymore. Because initially when I came, people were like, oh, you're a crazy idiot. You can't just, it's not the same, it's not this. And then I realize now, yes, I am a crazy idiot, but I'd rather tell you. You know, I'd rather be the guy standing at the corner with a sign that says the end is nigh, and then the asteroid never comes, and I go, yep, I was crazy, rather than to be the guy that the asteroid hits, and I'm like, ah, I saw it coming, I should have told you. So with regards to Zuma and Trump now, I tell people what I told them what I need to tell them, and I'll keep telling them, just look out for the links. It's going to be really simple. You follow the money. His family is going to be running the money. The businesses are going to be where the money is. You just follow the money with Trump, and you're going to find where he's exposing himself. Consistently, it's going to happen. But I also look to other countries beyond South Africa. For instance, recently, you know, I read a beautiful article from an Italian journalist who broke down how they finally defeated Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. And he was talking about how in Italy they were up against Berlusconi, who is also a parallel of Donald Trump. He was a reality TV show businessman who came in. He was a mogul. He was a populist. He promised all these things. And the mistake they made in Italy was they tried to beat him based on his personality, which is a lot of what the Democrats did. This man and his temperament and the way he speaks and what he says, instead of focusing on their promises. And he brings you into his game. Instead of you telling people what you're going to do, you tell people who he is not. You focus on his personality, which in a strange way ingratiates him to an audience. And when reading that in Italy, I realized the way they essentially ended up beating Berlusconi was they ignored his quirks and they focused only on his policy. They said, we don't care about, it's the equivalent now of Donald Trump. You go, so what if he tweets? We don't care. We don't care about his tweeting. We don't care about what we care about is the substance. If the tweet has nothing to do with substance, we move on. Is there substance? We move on. What did he say? He was on the phone with, do you care that he was on an unsecured line? No. What we care about is what he said on that unsecured line to a foreign leader. And so when you start thinking beyond, you know, the circus that's laid in front of you, and when you start looking internationally, I find it amazingly illuminating. You get answers from other countries because they've gone through it. You know, this is America's first third world president, and and so you have to look to the third world to get some answers. Yeah, welcome to the Banana Republic.
First of all, thank you so much for being who you are and being this presence in the world right now.
Thank you.
Secondly, you mentioned that books were the big investment in your family, and that's very charming to me as a book lover. Could you share 1, 2, 3 titles that were particularly important or favorites of yours? And finally, could you comment a little more, perhaps, than you already have implied, the power for change, the power of the media, the power of celebrity, all of these things together to help resolve conflict and not just report on it or lie about it?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. We're in a very tough situation where people have to realize that the media is no longer this monolith that it once was. We are slowly becoming the media. I said this to a friend once. I said, you realize paparazzi, for all intents and purposes, is now defunct because everyone is paparazzi. People take pictures of celebrities and tag it and put it online. Just spotted Angelina Jolie here. Just spotted this person at this airport. That used to be the job of the paparazzi. And now people with social media are doing the same thing. The same goes for media itself. There was a man in Austin, Texas, who had maybe 200 followers on Twitter. He saw a row of buses lined up near a protest that was taking place, an anti-Trump protest. He tweeted, just saw the buses that brought in all of the protesters. It seems that they have all been bussed in. This is not an organic protest. That story from a tiny, tiny, tiny account blew up, got retweeted, got reddited, got subreddited, became an article that really, really exploded, and within a few days had been recirculated 15, 20, 30,000 times on different news sites, only to find that the buses were there for a convention, and the company that was running the convention, they said, no, those are our buses. And the bus owner, the guy who ran the buses is from New Jersey, and he said, no, these are my buses. What the hell is going on here? But that story had spread. You know, it's spread. It's that famous quote where they say, you know, a lie has gone halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to put its pants on. And I was always fascinated by that quote because, first of all, I was like, why does truth not have its pants on? What was truth doing? But secondly, it really is, because a lie is so much easier to circulate. You don't have to think about it, you know? And that person went back on their account and said, false, I was wrong. No one cared about that. That didn't go anywhere. But that person created media. That person was part of something. And then he said, to his credit, this guy, he said, I didn't think I had that much influence. In the future, I will be more vigilant. And we all have to be more vigilant. The question is, though, do people care about being vigilant? Because these days it feels like people care more about amplifying viewpoints that echo what they want to say as opposed to critical thinking. Now I'm trying to remember what your first question was.
It was about books. Your favorite
about books. My favorite books growing up. Well, now I love reading autobiographies. But when I was a kid, I was a sucker for fantasy. You know, I was a kid that was trapped in the house because my grandmother was scared the police would take me away. So I lived indoors, and a book could take me halfway around the world or even into another world. So, you know, I was deeply in love with, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia. I loved reading any book that had stories that were fantastical. My favorite author of all time was Roald Dahl. I loved his storytelling. Yeah. I loved the characters. One of my favorite books growing up was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. You know, because, I mean, if you think about it, it was the story of this kid who grew up and he was poor, and then one day gets called out of the blue to come and see the workings of this magical factory, and the next thing you know, he's taking it over. And I go, that's almost the story of me with John Stewart. So, so in essence, you know, those books were my those books were my solace.
Well, because she was such a big part of your book and our conversation, I'll ask the final question about your mom. Is she surprised by what you're doing now and your meteoric improbable rise, or does she find it consonant with her experience of you, and does she take appropriate credit for your success?
I don't think my mom is surprised, but I don't think she expected it. You know, I think she's pleasantly surprised, if anything. My mom doesn't take anything for granted. And because I was a terror as a child, there was always the possibility that my life could have gone, you know, in a very different direction. There was always the cloud of crime growing up in a poor area. Mm-hmm. There were always so many different paths that I could have taken in life. So my mom never, ever takes that for granted. With regards to my success, my mom has almost been immune, you know, to the allures of fame, because in her world, I was famous when I was born. You know, she always tells me these stories, and I knew it as a kid. My mom adored me. You know, she adored me. She didn't spoil me, but she adored me. You know, she always made me feel wanted, which is the greatest gift I believe any human being can give another, especially a parent to a child. The knowledge that you've been chosen, you know, because so many of us battle with us every single day. Just the notion that we have a right to be here, which seems like a thing that many of us believe. But when you look yourself in the mirror, do you truly believe that? Do you believe that you have the right to exist? That was one thing my mother believed in me. She believed that I belonged and I had a right to exist. And so fame and, you know, all of this doesn't really affect her. It doesn't add much to her world in terms of how she views me. But for her, the metric that she uses when it comes to my life, and it's a metric that I have started to take on, is not how popular or famous or successful I am, but rather how much good or how positively I can affect other people's lives. And so my mom will never say to me, congratulations on the Daily Show, congratulations on that comedy tour. No, my mom and I talk every single morning, and we chat via email. And no, it's hilarious. That's how we still do that. So because what happened was she used to text me. And then texting is very expensive in South Africa. We don't have unlimited plans. Maybe we just started them now, but we never had unlimited plans. And then I told her about email. I said, you realize you can email unlimited for free all the time. And that was a horrible mistake on my part. Because she now uses it accordingly. So every single morning when I wake up, there is a scripture in my inbox. There is a message. And the best part is, she doesn't really care for formatting when she talks to me, so she writes the entire message in the subject field. Like the whole thing. She'd be like, how are you? Hope you're subject. How are you? Hope you're well. Your brother's not doing his homework. Talk to him. Look after yourself. I hope you're treating yourself well. Love you lots. Don't forget to read the Bible. Bless you. Goodbye. And then the message body will be, kind regards, mom. That's all the message. So sometimes, like, I'll get emails, I'm like, it's empty. And I'm like, no, the subject is the message. So every day we chat like that every single day. We really, it's real curt, but really, really, you know, like, we know each other. So it's just back and forth. It's not long-winded in any way. But she always, that's the one thing she'll write to me. She'll say, I just bumped into a woman who had a son who is also mixed race. She said, he looks at you as a role model. Mm. Thank you for being a positive influence. Just met a couple who said their husband was in hospital and they brought him the DVD and he was laughing while in a hospital bed. Thank you for making people laugh. Thank you for saying a good thing. Thank you. That's the biggest thing my mom gives me and fills me with. She goes, are you giving to others? Are you making your world a better place? Then I'm proud of you. Everything else is superfluous. It has nothing to do with me. And that's how I live.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Trevor Noah. This program was recorded on November 21st, 2016, at the Sidney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman-Rondazzo. The Post-Production Director is Nina Thorson. The Sidney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Steve Eckerd. House Manager, Lucy Faulkner. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sidney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Hawes Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.